Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today we're talking about the God of Thunder, Thor Odinson, one of my favorite gods in all of mythology. I even got pumped up for it by listening to Twilight of the Thunder God by Amanda Marth before we recorded this. In this episode, we're going to compare the quick-tempered, impatient, rebellious, and guileless mythological figure with the comic book film superhero character from Marvel Comics.
Yeah, the two versions of Thor are not the same at all, despite the Marvel version being loosely based on the Norse myth. The Asgardians of the Marvel Universe are like what I like to call Kirby gods, who are cosmic beings with loose connections with classical mythology. Jack Kirby had a way of making his gods look awe-inspiring and epic, but they're very much comic book gods and not what you would find in Viking legends. Still, I think Kirby's distinct vision for his gods are part of the reason why this version of Thor has lasted as long as it has.
You know, I think you're right about that. I think had they stuck with just the mythological version, I think that as a comic book film character, Thor would be less popular now. They really needed to change things around a bit to appeal to the modern audience and make Thor work as a comic book character. So let's talk about those things for a minute. There are some major differences between the two depictions that I would like to bring to the forefront. The first of which has to be that Thor has red hair and not blonde. And to my knowledge, all the depictions of Thor except one show him with a thick red beard and not clean shaven. Also, Thor is not Loki's adopted brother in the myths. Loki is at best a traveling companion and at worst an enemy. But Thor does have brothers by way of Odin Allfather, such as Tyr and Balder. There are a couple other duos in Thor's life that come up in the myths, but are not even mentioned in the MCU. The first is Thor's two servants, Thjalfi and Röskva, who are siblings. My guess is that's because the idea of having servants has changed considerably since the 13th century, especially here in America, where we have very strong feelings about slavery. The second duo comes from the two mythological goats that pull Thor's chariot or cart. Tangrisnir and Tangjoster, sorry, those are hard to pronounce for me, that he eats every day only to have them resurrected and ready for another trip across the sky the next day. But even when it comes to Thor's powers and where he gets them from, it's very different in the myths. In the MCU, all of Thor's powers come from Mjolnir. There's no mention in the MCU of his magical belt Megingjord, which vastly increases its strength. And that's a key factor in the myths, where, like Hercules of Greek myths, strength is Thor's main physical attribute. And speaking of his hammer, even with Thor's great strength, he has to have magical iron gauntlets called Jarngriper, which means iron grippers, to wield the powerful weapon in one hand. The reason is that when the dwarf Sindri, son of Ivaldi, forged Mjolnir for Loki, it was not in a dying star. But anyway, Loki turns into a fly and bit him on the eyelid, which is weird. But it caused Sindri to make Mjolnir's handle too short for Thor to hold on to with just one hand. And he needed Jarngriper to grip onto the powerful hand. And while we're on the subject of Mjolnir, in the myths, it was not just a weapon of mass destruction. It was also a tool for divine blessings of all types. People from every walk of life prayed to Thor for his blessings. The hammer symbol of Mjolnir was even used as a ceremonial tool in weddings and funerals. And last but not least, Mjolnir could not give others the power of Thor, nor was it unliftable by anyone who was not worthy. In fact, the giant Thrym stole it from him once in an effort to force Freya to marry him. That is a hilarious story that we actually covered in our Mythological Foundations episode, so I won't go into it here.
Well, that's a good summation of the major differences. Also, the mythic Thor from the legends isn't quite the noble prince of Asgard that we see in the comics or the films. He could be a brutal and rage-driven warrior and not always the brightest bulb in the shed, so to speak. I'd suggest reading Neil Gaiman's book called Norse Mythology, which actually has been adapted recently in comic book form by Dark Horse, if you want to see what Thor really was like in the legends. The Marvel version is more, a more princely and dignified figure with more of a Shakespearean influence in Stan's dialogue and characterization. Mike, do you want to get a bit more into the personality differences?
Sure, but if I can address your comment there real quick, I think the key reason for that dignified nobility we see in the comics and in the films comes down to adding that worthy factor to his powers. That one point really just changed the whole game for the character.
Oh, yes, for sure. That makes perfect sense. I'm not aware of the legends ever having a worthiness requirement to wield the hammer of Thor, but it's a huge part of what makes the Marvel version the hero he is, because Thor often has to prove himself worthy to maintain his powers in these stories. It's an element that helps to set him apart from the myths.
You're right about that not being in the myths, and I mean, like, at all. And it definitely sets the two versions apart. But let's talk about how different the mythological and comic book versions are in their personalities. Thor in the myths has little use for subtlety or tact. You won't ever see him making some grand plan, as he doesn't think more than one move ahead in any situation. Also, despite being tricked by magic and shape-shifting on several occasions, he keeps falling for it, as if learning from his mistakes is not a major concern from him. But for all his faults in this manner, it is because there is no lie in Thor. He is who he is, and he is incapable of deceiving anyone, and I think that that blinds him from thinking that others could be doing this to him. Mythological Thor's approach is rash, direct action, over discussing the problem or making a strategy to fix it. But it is decisive nonetheless. This is in stark contrast with his MCU counterpart outside the first movie, which I would describe as the journey from Thor of myth to the Thor of Marvel, but we'll get into that later. But later on, we see him actually leading the people of Asgard, something I don't think the mythological Thor could have accomplished.
Oh, true. The Marvel Thor displays occasional moments of rashness or brutal honesty, but not to the extent that the myths portray it. I also don't see the mythic Thor as a leader in the way that the Marvel version is. Marvel's Thor is a warrior prince, with both sides of that being in balance most of the time. You typically have to anger Marvel Thor to get him to be really violent for the most part, barring very unusual exceptions like Warrior's Madness. The mythological Thor is a bull in a china shop with no grace or subtlety at all, and he will rip you apart if you cross him. But there's also the question of his powers and his aspects, isn't there?
There certainly is. While Thor is a brute, without a doubt, there are deeper layers to him than that. Thor is not just associated with storms and lightning either. He was also closely tied to water in many ways, including the sea itself. He is even credited for creating the tides when Skrymir had him drink from that horn connected to the ocean. Thor is also shown rowing further out into sea than anyone else and crossing dangerous rivers. While this speaks of his brave and exploratory character, to the people it also spoke of his role as a protector god who removes boundaries and goes out before them as a guide. Even our weekday, Thursday, is derived from a specific day of the week, Thor's Day, where Thor was honored. In the MCU, he is definitely a protector, but he was not cherished and honored in quite the same level, nor did he fulfill these things for the people, but perhaps this is what the MCU was trying to show by having him lead the Asgardians.
Oh, that's interesting. The funny thing now is that when we think of Thor's Day now, it's usually in terms of Marvel's Thor. What you say makes sense, though, because storms are often connected with sea gods in ancient myth as much as they are with sky gods. Poseidon also had power over storms in Greek myth, and he was associated with storms at sea, even if Zeus had power over the lightning and the thunder. Thor filled a similar role for the Norse gods, it sounds like, but both versions of Thor are considered the protector of Midgard, even if their approaches to that are very different depending on which Thor we're talking about.
It's true. I think that's in large part because of another major difference between the Marvel character and the mythological one. In the myths, Thor's mother is not Frigga, but rather the Jotun Yord. And here's the key thing that ties into what you were saying. Yord actually means earth. Even Thor's wife, Sif, is associated with earth and fertility. But more than that, despite Thor's godly powers and exploits, he was considered a god of the people. Thor was relatable to common folks in a way that almost made it seem as if he could be like one of them because of his personality. That's one of the reasons he is the most attested and worshipped god in the Viking Age.
It makes sense that Thor was a relatable god to the people who followed him. It may be what drew Stan to adapt the character. So let's talk about the Marvel version of Thor, which is the one probably most people today are familiar with. Marvel's Thor was created in 1962 by Stan Lee, Stan's brother Larry Lieber, and Jack Kirby in Journey into Mystery number 83. Now, the fact that Thor debuted in the 83rd issue might sound a little surprising, especially in a title that's synonymous with Thor today. However, Journey into Mystery goes back into the 50s when Marvel was Atlas Comics. Back in those days, the book was about monsters and science fiction B-movie concepts. By this time, the Hulk had already come out, and Stan wanted a way to one-up the Hulk in terms of pure strength. There's an interesting quote from Stan that describes his creative process and why he developed Thor the way he did. Quote, "How do you make someone stronger than the strongest person? It finally came to me. Don't make him human, make him a god. I decided readers were already pretty familiar with the Greek and Roman gods. It might be fun to delve into the old Norse legends. Besides, I pictured Norse gods looking like the Vikings of old with the flowing beards, horned helmets, and battle clubs. Journey into Mystery needed a shot in the arm, so I picked Thor to headline the book. After writing an outline depicting the story and the characters I had in mind, I asked my brother Larry to write the script because I didn't have time."
Well, that settles a huge fanboy debate. Thor is stronger than Hulk.
Well, that was definitely Stan's intention, though Hulk has the madder Hulk gets, stronger Hulk gets thing in his favor. But Stan always loved giving even his most powerful characters some kind of vulnerability, as we've seen with characters like Daredevil. In the case of Thor, Stan gave Thor a mortal identity named Dr. Donald Blake. Blake was human, but like Matt Murdock, he also had a disability. He needed a cane to walk properly. Because the core of Thor's origin was overcoming arrogance, the godly essence of Thor was contained within the human body of Blake as a punishment by Odin. So Blake would simply tap the cane on the ground and he would transform into Thor. If Thor let go of the hammer for more than a minute, he transformed back into Blake. But while this idea wouldn't stick, it also gave Thor a human supporting cast, including Jane Foster, who was Blake's nurse in the original stories.
You know, you bring up something interesting there about Thor's human cast in the comics that really, it always kind of bugged me a little. You know, while I don't mind writing a human love interest like Jane Foster into the story, I really liked the idea of Sif with Thor. I mean, at least from a mythological standpoint. Thor has a close connection with the Earth through his mother, Yord, as I mentioned before, and through his wife, Sif's association with Earth and fertility. Add to that Thor is Earth's protector, and him being a favored god of the people of Earth, Sif just seemed like a natural fit. I was bummed to see that the MCU also made Sif a great warrior, which should have cemented her relationship with Thor even further. But instead, Sif's love is appreciated, but is ultimately unrequited by Thor, who had only monogamous eyes for Jane Foster. But in the myths, Thor was not even faithful to Sif. He had children with the Jotun, or giant, for those of you who may be unfamiliar, Yarn Saxa, I can talk, in addition to those with Sif. And as a quick side note, Sif and Thor had a daughter named Thrudr, who may or may not be the Valkyrie of the same name. I'm figuring that's where the MCU was going with the Valkyrie from Thor Ragnarok, simply called Scrapper 142. But, I mean, can you shed any light on that possibility, Steve?
I'm genuinely with you on Sif, and in fairness, she's definitely one of the main love interests in Thor's life as well. I like Sif and Thor together. I think that part of the reason is that Sif was Thor's wife in the myths, and there's just a natural connection between them for that reason. She has the childhood friend factor that gives a real advantage in these kinds of stories, too. And Sif is also immortal, and she just has more in common with Thor generally. I get where Stan was coming from with the Jane Thor Sif triangle. He wanted Thor to choose between his two halves, his mortal identity as Blake and his divine identity as Thor. At the same time, there's a reason Jane got dropped as a love interest for years. She just wasn't that interesting at the time.
That's interesting. So there is a stronger bond between Sif and Thor in the comics. I do like adding that Sif and Thor were childhood friends, too. They put that in the MCU version. I really like that. But I don't recall any mention of Thor and Sif as childhood friends in the myths. It does, however, bring them closer together, and I like that. I'm a fan of that either way. However, being unfamiliar with the dynamics of the Jane-Thor-Sif love triangle you described makes me wonder how that went. I mean, did Sif ever try to kill Jane?
I remember them being romantic rivals and not liking each other that much, but it was never overly serious. I mean, it was usually done in the way Silver Age romances worked. I mean, Sif mostly held back because she knew Thor cared about her and didn't want to get in the way. And Jane didn't know how she could fit in Thor's world to begin with. I wouldn't be surprised if Jane felt a bit inadequate in comparison to Sif, but the stories usually treated the worlds of gods and mortals as not being all that compatible, especially when love was involved.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. And it's actually reflective across all mythologies, I think. All powerful and immortal gods don't mix well with the very fragile and temporary mortals of humankind. I can't help but think of how Elrond explained to Arwen how ultimately tragic it is for the immortal that is left behind in the relationship. But there are surely some feelings of inferiority on the part of the mortals as well. I mean, how could there not be when you talk about their power differences and the temporal limits of their life? I mean, they are not equals. So, I mean, I like how they handled that, actually.
Yeah, Stan always had a way of bringing the humanity to the mythic. As for your question on Valkyrie and Thor's daughter, who's a character that interests me, by the way, I don't think that there was any intent to make a mythological connection there. I assume they were just adapting the original Valkyrie from the Defenders comics. And she was based on Brunhilde from Germanic legend and Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung. But in the end, looking at the character, I think Valkyrie from the film is her own character with no real connection to anybody.
I suppose that makes more sense in the Marvel setting. I didn't know about the Valkyrie character, but I like the actual tie-in with the myth. I'm curious, though. Brunhilde is the daughter of the Germanic Woden, aka the Norse Odin Allfather, just like Thor. And Brunhilde's mother is the Germanic Earth goddess Erda, the personification of Earth. Thor's mother is the Norse Earth goddess Jord, the giantess who is the personification of Earth. It would seem that, if not for cultural interpretational differences, Thor and Brunhilde might be brother or sister. Does anything like this come up in the comics?
Not in terms of Thor and Brunhilde being brother and sister, no. I've never seen that mentioned or addressed in any Thor or Defender stories that I've read. Though it is interesting that you bring up Jord, because the Marvel version complicates things there quite a bit. In the Marvel Universe, Jord is an aspect of the Earth goddess Gaea, who is an elder goddess and the sister of elder gods like Set and Cathan. This makes Thor the son of Odin and the divine embodiment of the Earth itself, which is why Thor has such a strong connection to Midgard and what makes him the Earth's protector. There have been attempts made to retcon this in Avengers by claiming his mother was the Phoenix, but nobody accepts this version, including people like Donnie Cates who have written the character. The commonly accepted take by most people, including I admit myself, is that Jord was Gaea and that Gaea is the true mother of Thor.
Wow. I did not know any of that, but I do like it. I like that even deeper connection with the Earth and with the older Greek goddess. I can actually see the logic behind that, and I think maybe if I was in that same situation, I probably would have done the same thing myself.
It does have a very Omenverse approach to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I can't deny that it works for Marvel. Anyway, since the character debuted, Thor features were the headline in Journey into Mystery as he became a popular character. And after a while, Asgard took over the whole book. The features turned into Tales of Asgard, which focused on stories about the other Asgardians like Baldur and Sif and so forth. So the book went from a science fiction book to full-on magic and mythology, with the only thing in common being that it was a book about monsters. If you tried this kind of thing today, it would probably open up a world of controversy. But Stan Laring, Jeff got away with it without a hitch. You've got to give him credit for that. Around this time, though, Thor became a huge player in another well-known title, becoming a founding member of the Avengers. Thor's mythos becomes important in the first issue, too, as the villain of that story was none other than his adopted brother and arch-nemesis, Loki. That works, though, because Loki's the kind of threat that justifies the existence of the team like the Avengers. Loki tries to use the Hulk to fight Thor, and through a series of events, ends up creating a team of superheroes. Thor would end up taking a leave of absence after Captain America took over the team, but he took a clear place as one of the big three of the Avengers ever since then.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about that. Why did Thor leave after Cap took over? I always thought Thor had like a great amount of respect for Cap, and it sounds like maybe that wasn't always the case.
No, it had nothing to do with their relationship. I mean, Thor always respected Cap as a fellow warrior and as a leader. It was more a situation where Stan wanted the original Avengers out of the way, and he wanted to set up the kooky quartet of Cap, Hawkeye, Quicksilver, and the Scarlet Witch. So Thor had other obligations that kept him busy, so that led Thor to take a leave of absence from the team. But he eventually came back to the Avengers, as he always did.
You know, I'm glad he came back. It really isn't the Avengers without Thor, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's a key member of that group. Thor was also instrumental in getting another Avenger on the team after a classic misunderstanding battle. One of my favorite classic Thor stories features the first battle between Thor and the Greek god Hercules. Hercules is manipulated into fighting Thor by his uncle Pluto, aka Hades, another god who is nothing like his mythic origin. And then Thor has to knock some sense into Herc. The Jack Kirby cover is iconic and has been homaged numerous times, including by Walt Simonson during the Beta Ray Bill story he did. But the fight itself is really beautifully staged, and you can tell that Kirby was drawing on his own fighting experience when he crafted that scene. Every hit is so huge and impactful, and when these two gods fight, it looks and feels epic in every single frame. Anyway, that conflict is resolved, and Thor and Herc becomes friends, and Thor eventually gives his endorsement for Hercules to join the Avengers. And as an aside, the early Hercules stories and Roy Thomas's Avengers run are some of my favorite issues featuring Marvel's version of Herc. It's worth tracking down those Thor and Avengers reprints if you can find them.
Man, I bet that was epic. I mean, I could feel the rumble of the ground with each blow just hearing you describe it. It's also interesting that those two would come to blows. Romans, who were the earliest recorders of the Germanic people from which the Vikings came, would use a process known as Interpretatio Romana, where the characteristics perceived to be similar to Romans result in the identification of non-Roman gods as Roman deities. They used this to substitute the name Thor for the Greco-Roman god Hercules, or even Jupiter or Jove. I feel like that this might have been a subtle nod to that.
Oh, very possibly. Stan and Jack definitely knew their history and did their research, so it could have been that some of it was intentional and deliberately thought out, as you described. So let's get back to the God of Thunder. The Stan, Jack, and Larry issues are a lot of fun, and they hold up very well, at least of what I've read of them. However, I can't say the same for a lot of the Bronze Age Thor stories, which I'm sad to report aren't all that memorable. There are a few notable events like the Deviant Saga, where Thor meets the Eternals, but mostly Thor wasn't that exciting up until the 80s. But the one creator that truly put Thor on the map was writer and artist Walter Simonson. Simonson was part of that 70s and 80s generation of writer-artists that defined Marvel for many years, including the likes of Frank Miller and Jim Starlin. But Simonson always had a passion for Norse mythology, something that he pursued even after writing and drawing Thor. Most recently, he even did a comic about Ragnarok and the fall of the gods. To this day, Walt Simonson's run on Thor is regarded as the definitive run on the book, even though there are others that might be more arguable now. Simonson decided to change elements of Thor, focusing more on the Asgardian mythos and Thor as a monster hunter. Simonson removed the Donald Blake identity, something that stuck for decades after, and honestly didn't take away that much from the character. He gave depth and character development to classic enemies like Loki and Amora the Enchantress, who is basically Marvel's Freya. He adapted classic mythic villains to the Marvel Universe, creating his own versions of the fire demon Surtur, Jormungandr, the World Serpent, the Dragon Fafnir, Amora's sister Lorelei, and others that had real impact on Thor's rogues gallery. He developed the relationships between the gods, including Baldur's complicated romance with Carnilla the Norn Queen. He did things previously considered unthinkable, like killing Odin, which is the first time that this happened, and setting up Baldur to rule Asgard in his place. Walt Simonson also created genuinely new and lasting characters to the Thor mythos as well. He started off with a bang, creating an alien version of Thor called Better Ray Bill. Bill ends up claiming Mjolnir briefly and becomes Better Ray Thor, because Bill is such a good and noble warrior that he qualifies as worthy in the eyes of Odin. Odin is so impressed with Bill, in fact, that he creates another hammer called Stormbreaker for Bill to use. And he even gives Bill a place among the Asgardians. Bill also ends up forming a close relationship with the goddess Sif, and I honestly love their relationship.
Well, if Marvel's Thor wasn't going to be with Sif, at least she found a warrior as noble as Thor, even if they don't have the same connections.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Bill is a pretty caring and gentle guy, between the Thor aspect, the alien nature, and the horse-like face. And we see that side of him come out when he's with Sif. If it was done by anybody other than Walt Simonson, I mean, Bill would come across as a pretender. But Better Ray Bill is such a cool and likable character, and Simonson takes his time developing him, so it never feels that way. The other major creation that Simonson brought to Thor is one of Thor's nastiest villains, the dark elf Malekith the Accursed. Malekith ends up having a huge impact on Jason Aaron's run on Thor, and he becomes the architect of the War of the Realms event. But Simonson's introduction made Malekith a memorable villain, giving Thor a villain so evil and cruel that he even gives Loki pause. As bad as Loki is, he at least cares about Asgard and about his family. I mean, there are things Loki won't do. Malekith will burn the Nine Realms to the ground if it means causing chaos, and he cares about nothing but his own desires. He is a truly frightening villain and probably Thor's greatest nemesis after Loki these days.
I gotta say, I really like Malekith as a villain as well. I mean, you talked about Journey into Mystery being a monster hunter kind of book, but Malekith is most terrifying of monsters because he is pure evil down to his soul. I mean, in the words of Kyle Reese, you can't reason with him. He doesn't feel pity or remorse, and he will not stop.
Oh, exactly. I mean, he's a pure evil character done well. As you might be able to tell, I adore the Simonson run. Even the smaller stories have weight and meaning. There's one issue where Thor encounters the last true Viking who must overcome his past cowardice and earn his place in Valhalla. Through his own bravery, Thor inspires the last Viking to face his death with honor and courage. This kind of issue really hits what makes Thor a hero, while also dealing with Thor as immortal in the modern world. You even get the occasional silly thing, like Thor turning into a frog and finding a way to break the curse. It's these kinds of tales, I mean, full of magic and wonder and heroism, that sets Simonson apart from many of the great Thor runs, and shows why it's as beloved as it is.
Ah, yes, the Frog Prince, Puddle Gulp, a.k.a. the Mighty Thunder Frog.
Oh, man, it's a moment in Thor's history that gets laughed at a lot, I admit. And it's a really funny idea to see this Asgardian warrior god as a frog. Simonson liked to have fun with Thor from time to time, in between the really big epic stories. But it also has that fairy tale quality that really works for Thor. Now, the next major run came from Tom DeFalco, who had been Marvel's editor-in-chief from the late 80s to the early 90s. DeFalco tends to be associated with two major things. His work on Spider-Man, and for my part, his beloved run on Spider-Girl, and his long run on Thor. He worked quite a bit with artist Ron Frenz, and they tended to do a lot of classic and back-to-basics type of stories. I will admit that I have not read a lot of this run, but it did contribute a number of ideas and characters that have come back over the years. And as an aside, they also created the New Warriors, so gotta give them props for that. But probably the character that is best remembered out of the DeFalco run is Eric Masterson, the original Thunderstrike. This was the first attempt to get back to giving Thor a human avatar. And DeFalco decided that the way to do that was to give Thor an everyman human character to bond with, since Thor himself was an everyman character. Eric Masterson was an architect and a single father who ended up being bonded with Thor. And incidentally, Eric is the Thor you see in the Infinity Gauntlet series, if you wonder why he doesn't seem to act like himself in that run.
I totally remember Eric. He was actually kind of my Marvel Comics Thor, having only read a few issues of the Donald Blake version. And I was really happy when he got his own series, too.
Oh, yeah. Eric was a good character from what I remember, though I didn't read a lot of him. But eventually, Eric became separated from Thor, and they went back to being separate beings. He got his own magical mace, which gave him Thor-like powers. And he'd take the name of Thunderstrike, which is a cool name, by the way. Eric actually got his own series for a little while before it was ultimately canceled. And then Eric got a heroic death, passing the mace and powers down to his son, Kevin, who would take the Thunderstrike name in another mini by DeFalco. But by this point, we had a few different Thors, and this led to the idea of the Thor Corps, featuring the original Thor, Beta Ray Bill, Thunderstrike, and a future Thor named Dargo Couture. The idea would be brought back from time to time after this, even in modern Thor stories.
You know, making multiple versions of characters seems to be Marvel's thing. It kind of implies, really, that there's some type of, I don't know, a universal imperative that requires the existence of the Marvel heroes.
Oh, yeah, true. You get a lot of replacement characters in the 80s and 90s. I mean, early on, many of these stories were about showing who the main character was by having somebody else be in the role for a while. And you got that with John Walker as Cap, but you also had Jim Rhodes as Iron Man. But by the time the Thor Corps came around, I mean, you already had three different Thors by that point, so why not have them team up? It was a pretty natural setup. Now, Thor stories were mostly not memorable late into the 90s. I did like the Blood and Thunder event by Jim Starlin and Ron Mars. Thor comes down with a condition called Warrior's Madness that drives him berserk, and he flies across the universe in Odin's longship searching for a cure. This leads into a battle between the Asgardians and Adam Warlock's Infinity Watch, which is really awesome. It also has an epic fight between Thanos and Odin himself, a battle that lays waste to the city of Asgard. Not a typical Thor story, but it's fun while it lasts. Warren Ellis and Mike Diodato Jr. Also did a fairly decent story called World Engine. Around this time, Thor and Amora the Enchantress get together briefly as a couple, and it's pretty entertaining to watch those two interact in that story. But aside from that, I can't think of a whole lot of stories from that time that really jumped to my mind. So after the Heroes Were Reborn event, when Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld took over the Avengers and the FF for a year, all that changed. And then that started Heroes Return, where Thor was relaunched with a new first issue by two legends, Dan Jurgens and John Romita Jr. Jurgens had come off as Superman, and he starts off doing more back-to-basics Thor stories, and again bonds Thor to a human host. This character is a nurse named Jake Olsen, who eventually gets dropped. But John Romita Jr. was an inspired choice to draw the book because he always excels at doing these Kirby-style action and classic Marvel storytelling. But where this run gets really interesting is after Romita leaves the book and Jurgens starts getting experimental. So once again, Odin dies, but this time Thor is chosen to replace him as King of Asgard. Thor takes a huge power up and he takes on the Odin power and he becomes like an Odin-powered Thor. But more than that, Thor has to deal with his responsibilities as a king, including dealing with political affairs. So Thor has to balance his duties as protector of Midgard with his role as king of the Golden Realm. Eventually, this is rolled back by the end of the run, but for a while, you get some really cool stories. I'll also add two other Thor appearances during this period as well. One is probably my favorite Thor panel ever, and that was in a story called Ultron Unlimited in Kurt Busiek and George Perez's run on Avengers. The short of it is that Ultron wipes out all human life in the small country of Solarinia, and then he kidnaps several of the Avengers as part of his plan. During the rescue mission to stop Ultron, a very pissed off Thor single-handedly blows a huge hole in the side of Ultron's base, and with his hammer crackling with lightning, an indignant Thor says this, "Ultron, we would have words with thee." It's awesome, and one of my favorite moments from that entire run. Thor is full of righteous anger, and Perez just frames it beautifully.
That sounds pretty awesome. Honestly, before Marvel, if you had said that Thor would speak Shakespearean English, I would have laughed. But somehow, Marvel's Thor pulls it off and still sounds like a badass.
I still love the Shakespeare in the Park line from the first Avengers film, I must admit. But Stan's Shakespearean language sometimes made for epic moments when it was done well, like it was there. The other appearance from that time that I really liked was Thor's guest appearance in Peter David's run on Captain Marvel. Jennis, who is the son of Captain Mar-Vell, goes insane because of his cosmic awareness, and thinking that his new powers make him a god, he goes to Asgard looking for King Thor. It leads to the fight you might expect, and it's really cool. That whole series is outstanding, but the two Thor two-parter is really good, and Walt Simonson drew one of the covers too. But after that, we start seriously getting into the Joe Quesada era of Marvel, with Brian Michael Bendis completely shaking up the Avengers. I admit I didn't read a lot of Thor-related stuff around then, but I think you wanted to talk about what Thor was doing during Secret Invasion or so, Mike.
That this time period was in many ways launched by Loki reviving Surtur, the fire demon, and beginning Ragnarok, which, as it turns out, is not the end of all things like everybody thought. Something that is true even in the myths. The undead Volva, incidentally the same Volva from my Seder comic, who was raised by Jotnar, told Odin while he was in hell about the creation of Yggdrasil and the Nine Realms, all the way through the end of the world via Ragnarok. But she also spoke of the aftermath of that nightmare event. Sure, a lot of gods die and the world itself is destroyed, but she described the world being reborn again out of the waters, and what almost seems like a paradise taking root in the rebirth. Of course, it was a bit different in the comics, but I like that they touched on that common misconception about Ragnarok being the end. In fact, in the comics, Thor learns about deities who are gods even to the gods, called those who sit above in shadow, who feed on the cycle of death and rebirth that Ragnarok creates. In an effort to break that cycle, Thor confronts the Norns, who are supernatural beings, something akin to the Moirai, or fates of Greek myth, typically depicted as three women who spin or weave the fates of men. Anyway, in this confrontation, Thor severs the tapestry of Asgard's existence. Thor has possessed the portion of the Odin Force since his father Odin went into the interdimensional rift with Surtur, and he became the ruler of Asgard. So, after breaking the Ragnarok cycle by severing Asgard's existence, the Odin Force tells Thor that breaking the cycle of Ragnarok Odin created thousands of years ago with Surtur was his father's plan all along. And Thor enters into an Odin sleep, leaving his fellow Avengers unaware of where he is or what he's doing.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't read any of that, but the specter of Ragnarok comes back a few times in the comics. We first see it mainly with Simonson's run, Odin's battle with Surtur, and then Thor's big fight with Jormungand, the Midgard serpent. But it sounds like even though Thor averts Ragnarok, it's only delayed and not truly stopped because it comes back again and again in a cycle. Oh, and as an aside, those who sit above in shadow is it's a reference to the Asgardian War story from X-Men and New Mutants back in the mid-80s. That's honestly one of my favorite X-Men stories. It was basically Chris Claremont wanting to play in the Thor sandbox for a bit. He and Walt Simonson were friends for many years. So it led to two things. An X-Men Alpha Flight miniseries, which is where we first see those who sit above in shadow, and then a New Mutants special, and that year's X-Men annual that resolved the Asgardian Wars. It's interesting to see someone reference that story decades later. But getting back to Ragnarok, how does Thor figure into all this?
After Ragnarok was, as you say, put off for a time, and Thor entered into the Odin sleep, Mjolnir is eventually found on Earth and comes into the possession of Donald Blake, who, upon touching the hammer, Mjolnir, is transported into the void of non-existence where Thor is in his Odin sleep. Blake explains that when Odin removed his persona from Thor, he was teleported to the void of non-existence that Thor is in now. But when Odin died, Blake was suddenly restored back to this dimension and in New York City. Blake convinces Thor to take up Mjolnir again, return to Earth, and renew the dual identity with Blake. Thor does this and more, including once again becoming the King of Asgard, teleporting Asgard to Earth, and even manages to get out of the Superhuman Registration Act. But why don't you get into that one, Steve?
Yeah, sure. I can talk a bit about that. The main thing I remember around this time is that Thor's life starts getting a bit weird. The first superhero civil war starts, and Tony Stark's pro-registration faction starts doing some ruthless and underhanded things to win. The one that concerns Thor is that Tony's people engineered a clone of Thor and turned it on Cap's group. The clone dies during the Civil War, but eventually Thor finds out about what has been done to him, and he's understandably furious. Thor would never give his consent to make the clone, and he would not approve of using it again as his friends, especially Cap. So this strains Thor and Tony's friendship, which goes all the way back to the founding of the Avengers. This is addressed openly when J. Michael Straczynski takes over the Thor book for a while. Yes, this is the same JMS who created Babylon 5, which is, by the way, one of my favorite science fiction shows of all time. And he did a pretty notable run on Spider-Man around that same time period. But he also wrote Thor for about a year or so as well, and he picked up the pieces of the Civil War stuff. In fact, JMS makes a cameo in the first Thor movie as one of the people who tries to lift Mjolnir and fails.
Ah, that's pretty cool. I love the little writer and artist cameos in a comic book movie.
Oh, it's a cool moment in that film if you know who he is. But there's a reason JMS is remembered when it comes to Thor. Thor and Iron Man get into a fight in the early issues of the JMS run, a fight where Thor wins both the fight and the moral argument. Actually, it's less of a fight and more of a full-on beatdown, and it's so satisfying to see Tony pay the price for his hubris here. Thor just stops holding back and decides to give Tony a demonstration of what raw, unbridled power looks like. He's offended, he's deeply angry, and he's not in a mood to give Tony much in the way of forgiveness or restraint. To be honest, I think the only reason Thor stops short of telling Tony is the fact that Thor wants to keep Asgard out of the Civil War itself. So Thor lets Tony go to give the government his message, and they agree that Asgard will remain neutral. But at this point, Thor is just done with their friendship. It gets better eventually, and they do reconcile, but it takes a long time for Thor to get past this.
I actually liked that Tony convinced the government to save face after his ass-whooping from Thor by letting Asgard be regarded as a diplomatic embassy or mission separate from the United States and not technically bound by the Registration Act, because Asgard is technically floating a few feet above the ground and not actually on U.S. soil.
Oh, that's great. But probably for the best that Tony did that. I don't think a full-scale war between the government and Asgard would have gone over too well for anyone, which is probably why Thor did his best to prevent it. I mean, he does show some regal poise here. Now, the next really notable era to come after this came around the 2010s with Jason Aaron. I didn't follow a lot of Thor for a while, although Matt Fraction briefly did a run with Asad Ribic. The art was nice in that. Ribic, I think, eventually did Jason Aaron's Thor as well. But in terms of story, I think Thor is the book that Jason Aaron is perhaps best known for now. In fact, the upcoming Thor film, Blood and Thunder, draws a lot on what Aaron did on that title. Now, to be honest, I think I enjoy the early Aaron stuff the most because it has a lot of creative energy and it hits some of Thor's most interesting aspects. It's a complex run and it's not easy to do it all justice, but I'll do my best to describe it. We do see some Conan-style flashbacks in Thor's past, with Thor as a monster hunter aside a group of Viking warriors. This is intertwined with a storyline set in Thor's future where he's an old king with three granddaughters. And then you have Thor in the present where he comes face to face with one of his most interesting modern enemies, a villain called Gore the God Butcher, who will also be in the movie. I'll be honest, Gore is a really inspired idea for a villain. Thor tends to fight other gods or really strong mortals, but like the Absorbing Man. But Gore is a mortal who transcends into godhood, and he's driven by a deep hatred of gods because of the deaths of his family. It's not just that Gore is an atheist and doesn't believe in the gods. Oh, he believes in the gods, but he actively hates them because they refused to intervene when they were needed. So Gore goes out, acquires power, and uses it to murder every god he can find in revenge. He's essentially an anti-theist, I would say. And that's a really interesting idea for a villain. Gore is honestly a terrifying one. I'm not going to spoil what happens beyond that because I think this is a story you should read for yourself, but it's amazing stuff. After that, Malekith the Accursed comes back, and I think Aaron makes him an even nastier villain than he was under Simonson. Wow. He is just a depraved villain who enjoys causing chaos and manipulating people. A lot of what Aaron's doing with Malekith is this really long-term plan, which eventually leads to the War of the Realms events, which brings the war to run to the close. While I wasn't too crazy about the event itself, I love the idea of it, and I can't deny that Aaron made Malekith an A-list Thor villain. I gotta give Aaron this. He's really good at making his villains dangerous and scary. But I think what most people remember about Aaron's run is a bit more controversial, and that is when Thor loses his worthiness to wield the hammer, becoming the unworthy Thor. While I have my issues with the execution of this, and I don't think the way that they establish it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, I actually don't think it's a bad idea to have Thor fall for grace temporarily and fight for his right to once more wield the hammer. And eventually that does happen. Thor does reclaim Mjolnir and his worthiness to claim it, but it takes a long time to get there.
See, that's the kind of thing I was talking about earlier. Making Thor's power dependent on Mjolnir having and having the caveat of needing to be worthy completely changed the game for the character of Thor. It's the main reason I think the character ventures so far from the myths.
Oh, agreed. So much of who Thor is in the comics comes from the idea that Thor was punished for his past arrogance. It also ties into the fact that Thor is always trying to earn his father's approval. So there's always this element of Thor trying to prove his worth as a hero because it's tied into how Mjolnir works in the comics. But let's get back to the unworthy Thor stuff. In the meantime, Jane Foster, Thor's former love interest and now a doctor, takes the mantle of Thor in a manner similar to Eric Masterson. However, Jane has problems of her own because her mortal body comes down with cancer. And worse, the more that Jane uses the power of Thor, the closer she comes to death. By the end, she gets a heroic sacrifice and she becomes the new Valkyrie. And Thor Odinson once more reclaims the hammer.
You know, I always liked when a superhero's own powers are a detriment to their survival, or something equally terrible like what they did with Cap, the Cap run and the Super Soldier Serum, or with characters like Spawn, whose powers were quantified and served as a countdown to when he would have to lead Hell's Army. It adds a whole other level of gravitas to each moment.
Oh, it does. I can't really speak to how well the cancer angle was handled, but it's an interesting idea. It is a really divisive run, but eventually the original Thor does make his return, and Aaron wraps things up before he leaves. Donny Cates took over after Aaron left, and that presented a pretty daunting challenge for any writer, because that run was very hard act to follow. Cates is best known for his run on Venom, and I think he may be Eddie Brock's definitive writer at this point. And I admit I was pretty excited when he took over the book, even if I didn't stick it out for that long. But when it comes to Thor, I think Cates could be a bit more hit or miss for me. Usually come with these up with these really big and bold ideas that I don't think quite worked on an execution level. You'd get some really cool ideas like Thor becoming a Herald of Galactus briefly, or working out what really happened to Donald Blake. You'd get cool fights between Thor and Sif and Beta Ray Bill. But then he twists his ideas in a way that I just didn't really care for, like driving Don Blake completely insane, turning him into a villain and having him take Thor's place. I won't deny that his ideas are really interesting and that Cates has a creative boldness that serves him well. I like him as a writer when he thinks he's really suited to what he's working on, like he was with his Venom run. I just don't think everything he does is for me like it was here, and I can respect that.
You know, you make a good point there. Not liking where a story goes, or even the entirety of it, does not necessarily reflect on the skill of those who worked on it. You're not saying he did a bad job, just that it wasn't for you, and I like that.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you get a good writer who just doesn't hit the right notes for you, and that's okay. But I think that covers Thor's comics history, so why don't we get into the adaptations?
Sure. Let's start with the 2011 self-titled film Thor, the fourth film in the phase one of the MCU. Thor was directed by Kenneth Branagh and written by Ashley Edward Miller and Zach Zentz and Don Payne. The film stars Chris Hemsworth as the titular character Thor, alongside Natalie Portman as Jane Foster, Tom Hiddleston as Loki, Jamie Alexander as Sif, Stellan Skarsgård as Erik Selvig, Colm Feore as Laufey, and the Warriors. And as for the Warriors Three, Ray Stevenson as Volstagg, Tadanobu. Asanu as Hogan, and Josh Dallas as Frandrill. They also cast Idris Elba as Heimdall, Kat Dennings as Darcy Lewis, Renee Russo as Frigga, and Anthony Hopkins as Odin.
Kenneth Branagh was an interesting choice for this movie because he's best known as a Shakespearean actor and director. I think that shows that the real focus on this film was adapting the Thor that Stan, Larry, and Jack brought to the comics. I thought that they did a pretty good job in adapting most of the Asgardians, too. Seven the Warriors 3 were unfortunately underused in the MCU, but I like them a lot in this film. Loki is awesome, of course. Tom Hiddleston is a legend. But I was a bit underwhelmed by the mortal supporting cast. Especially Darcy, who I found annoying. Kat Dennings. But I think that they try to capture the conflict between Thor as a god prince and Thor as the protector of Midgard. While this movie is treated as the run of the litter when it comes to Phase 1 MCU films, I think it's an underrated film that deserves a bit more credit than it gets.
You know, I picked up a similar focus for the film with a slightly different twist, which I'll get into in a minute when we go over the story. But I would like to comment on the Warriors 3, however. While they are a fun group, they really only fit into the Marvel version of the mythos. There is no Warriors 3 in the Norse myth, and even the name is based off of Stan's Shakespearean dialogue and is not how they would have been referred to in the myths. But that anal rant aside, I do agree about Darcy being annoying. She's just too focused on herself to be a team player. I also agree about the 2011 film being better film than people say it is, but I'll get into why I think so here in a minute.
Awesome. But before we get into that, it's true that the Warriors 3 are an invention of Stan and Jack. And in fact, Stan leads in heavy on his Shakespearean influences with the Warriors 3. I'm convinced that Boldstag is Stan's version of the Fat Knight Falstaff. A major Shakespearean character from his play Henry V. Even the names sound pretty similar if you think about it. Like, Stan just took the Falstaff name and made it sound more like a Viking name. Stan admitted to taking a lot of Shakespearean influence in his comics, so I don't think it's much of a stretch.
I think you make a good argument there for Volstagg. I wouldn't even call that a stretch by what you're saying there. I think that makes perfect sense.
Volstagg is a cool character, it must be said, and he was adapted well in the film. I'll also add that Chris Hemsworth is an excellent Thor. He also gets overshadowed because Evans as Cap and Robert Downey as Iron Man are both top-tier casting, but Hemsworth captures both the dignity and the powerful presence of Thor, and he's just fun to watch when he's swinging that hammer. There's a swagger and a sense of fun that Hemsworth brings that fits the character, too. I think it's going to be hard to imagine anybody but Chris Hemsworth in that role for a very long time.
Definitely. I actually list Hemsworth as on par with Evans and Downey as perfectly cast for their roles. And for the reasons you described there, even how he speaks, especially when he's being dramatic, that is exactly how I hear Thor's voice when I read the comics.
Oh, agreed on that. Hemsworth makes him sound like Thor. He gets the Shakespeare in the Park stuff for sure.
All right, let's get into Thor's story in the film and my twist on your Marvel character adaptation theory. As I mentioned earlier, while this is an origin story for Thor in the MCU, I consider this to actually be a transition movie from the rash, quick-tempered, and rebellious Thor of Norse mythology to the noble warrior prince that the Marvel Comics character is. The reason is the first half of the movie, really. It starts out with a very basic but very Norse-sounding myth premise. And that is, in 965 AD, Odin, king of Asgard, waged a war against the frost giants of Jotunheim and their leader Laufey to prevent them from conquering the Nine Realms with the casket of ancient winters starting with Earth. The Asgardian warriors defeat the frost giants in Tonsberg, Norway, and seize the casket of ancient winters.
I think you've hit on something here. Thor is something of a transitional film, yes. But it also hits on the origin of Thor in the comics. Arrogance was Thor's huge flaw, and we needed to see that before he becomes the Thor we know and love by the end of the film. While I find that he becomes the character we recognize later, unquote, is sometimes used as a way to justify bad characterizations in some comic adaptations, I think it actually works here. It's rooted in the myths and in the early comics, and we do see that the character development that makes Thor the hero we recognize. I'll also add that the Casket of Ancient Winters is a MacGuffin that comes straight from the comics, so they did their reading.
Exactly. And another reason the movie is better than critics say. But I'd like to point out a random change in the story that I don't understand. Odin is seen standing over Laufey with his spear after the Frost Giant's defeat, and Odin is missing his right eye. They seem to imply here, as he had both eyes at the start of the battle, that he lost his right eye in the fight. I'm not sure anybody who is unfamiliar with the myths would even catch this, but that's not how Odin lost his eye at all. And I think it takes away from the character to do it that way. But let me tell you about the myth, and you can decide for yourself whether it's as messed up as I think it is. The story goes like this. While Odin Allfather was a powerful god, he wanted to learn all that there was to know, including all that was hidden from him. To gain wisdom, Odin went to Mimir, the wisest of the gods, who lived at the well at the base of Yggdrasil, which, for those of you who do not know, is the center of the nine realms in Norse mythology. Yggdrasil has three roots that grow in three directions. Beneath the first root is Hel, under the second is Jotunheim, and below the third root is Midgard and mankind. The gods assembled at Yggdrasil on a daily basis for their things. So, I mean, Yggdrasil was a sacred site. Anyway, Mimir told Odin that he could drink from the waters of this well, and that it would give him the divine wisdom that he was looking for. But first he would have to make a sacrifice. So Odin plucked out his own eye and offered it to Mimir as payment for his newfound wisdom by putting it into the well. Later on, after Mimir was beheaded during the Æsir-Vanir War, Odin carried around Mimir's head. It apparently told him the secret knowledge that he was looking for and provided counsel to him. That shows character and gives an origin for Odin's infinite wisdom.
Yeah, that was a very weird choice in the film, I grant you. And I'm not sure we needed to see Odin lose his eye like that. Even in the comics, Odin lost his eye through the sacrifice to Mimir in exchange for wisdom. That's a moment that establishes who Odin is in both the myths and the comics. I mean, he's a man who's willing to sacrifice himself to be a better king for the good of the Asgardian people. I can understand not needing to mention Mimir in the films, but they could just not have shown it and it would have been fine. You could have just implied it. It's just a really odd change they made there, and I don't think it adds anything.
Thank you. I'm glad to see they stuck with that in the comics, at least. And I think you're right. They could have simply showed him with the eye patch and not even gone there at all. But back to the story of the first film. Odin placed the casket of ancient winters in his vault, where it sat for over 1,000 years. But on the day of Thor's coronation as king of Asgard, just as Thor is rashly taking an oath to be a selfless, wise, and moral king, when he is clearly nothing but a boy trying to prove himself a man, frost giants, who were secretly allowed to sneak in by Thor's half-brother Loki, attack Asgard, seeking to reclaim the casket of ancient winters. But they are incinerated by the destroyer. While Odin, ever the wise king, sees this as the actions of but a few that were destined to fail and wants to continue to honor his truth with Laufey so as not to look for war, Thor sees the situation as only a young warrior might and not as a king. But Odin forbids Thor from marching into Jotunheim and teaching them a lesson so as to strike fear in them. Odin knows that this will only provoke a war with the Jotuns, and his fears are confirmed when Thor, Loki, Sif, and the Warriors Three go to Jotunheim to confront them and make them fear ever coming into Asgard again. Thanks to Thor seeking out battle and a snide remark from the Frost Giants, a battle breaks out, and just as Thor and his friends are about to become overwhelmed, Odin intervenes to save them, but the already fragile truce between the Asgardians and the Jotuns is now destroyed, and war is now imminent. For Thor's arrogance, Odin strips his son of his godly power and places it within Mjolnir and exiles Thor to Earth as a mortal until he's worthy of his power, of the power he possesses and his beloved hammer. Thor goes through what we learned from astrophysicist Dr. Jane Foster is an Einstein-Rosen bridge, aka a wormhole, and lands on Earth in New Mexico, just in time to be run over by Jane Foster, her assistant Darcy Lewis, and mentor Dr. Elvig Selvig. Eventually, Thor goes from the man-child warrior from the myth and the beginning of the film and into the beginnings of the noble warrior prince that we all know and love from the Marvel comics. And this is what I mean about the 2011 Thor film being a transitional story and not just an origin story. I think that fact sets it apart from any of the other Marvel origin stories, especially from Phase 1. This was brilliantly written for both Marvel fans and mythology fans as well, I think.
Oh, yeah, agreed. I think that that covers the first movie pretty well. And the Thor film respects both the legends and the comics quite solidly. I think if this had been the first Marvel movie, it might have made more of an impact than it did. It just tends to suffer in comparison to Iron Man, Cap the First Avenger, and the first Avengers film, all of which are outstanding. But I still think Thor is a really good film that respects the source material pretty well and gave Thor a pretty decent character arc. It's just a shame that it doesn't get more respect than it does.
Well, hopefully we've shown a little light on how good it is, and perhaps a few minds will be changed about the film. But even if you disagree, we hope that you can take away something from this episode that will make Thor an even cooler character. You know, the very first comic I ever bought was actually a Mighty Thor comic, and I bought it because I love the myth so much. I'm hoping maybe that experience gets passed on here. But that about wraps us up for this Thor episode. But before I go, I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.